Jonathan, how do you rectify these two things? Zero tolerance for anti-Semitism.
Sure.
Zero tolerance for diluting the First Amendment. How do you do it? You can't.
Well, I think there are things you can do, right? So I think you can choose to amplify or de-amplify certain phrases and statements.
Should crazy white supremacist Nazis be able to march?
Well, of course they should be able to march.
So they should
the
be
ADL
able to
defended the right of Nazis to march in Skokie. But maybe they shouldn't march right in front of the synagogue on a Saturday morning.
Right.
Like, there are ways we can have free speech and open dialogue.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have John Friend back on the show. Of course, John is a columnist for the American Free Press, host of The Realist Report and the AFP Report podcast. His website is The Realist Report. John, how are you doing?
Tim, I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for having me back. It's always quite an honor to speak with you. So thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show. Well, but some recent developments I thought that might have gotten your attention regarding our old friend Elon Musk and the ADL, and of course, I guess we could call it the organized Jewish community. It appears to be, I guess you could say, a feud between him and the ADL, and there seems to be working behind the scenes sort of an attempt to destroy his business, at least destroy Twitter. Recently, I think The Atlantic magazine ran an article exposing his grandfather as being a racist.
Yeah, I did see that. You know what? In The Atlantic, it was so annoying because you have to have a subscription to read a lot of their content. So I couldn't even read the whole article because I didn't have a subscription. But I did read that.
Is that Jeffrey Goldberg's magazine?
His grand. Yeah. It's the one of the. Yeah, so I didn't really get to read that whole thing because it was tied into the subscription or whatever. But yeah, they've really been going after Elon. And it's sort of strange. I mean, he did that Twitter space with Ben Shapiro and then a whole bunch of other rabbis and other Jewish leaders. And I mean, some of the quotes from that interview were just quite astonishing. I mean, he was basically saying how much he loves Jews. He said his whole entire life story is pro-Semitic and that he went to a Hebrew preschool when he was when he's grown up in South Africa. And, he may not be genetically Jewish, he said, but he's aspirationally Jewish. And, like, all of his best friends are Jews. Like, he said he had twice as many Jewish friends as non-Jewish friends.
What do you care? I'm not anti-Semitic.
Like, absolutely in love with Jews. And, like, yeah, exactly. It's kind of ridiculous. And you know, this has been sort of going on for, you know, playing out for the past, gosh, probably a couple months now. I mean, the whole ban the ADL hashtag really kind of went viral earlier this summer. And he's said some interesting things on Twitter and, you know, has kind of elevated that campaign and brought some attention to it, which is, you know, why they're so apoplectic with him. And, you know, anybody that's saying anything critical of organized Jewry or the ADL is like automatically denounced as an anti-Semite. But the whole entire discussion was really sort of interesting to listen to because they talk about quote unquote anti-Semitism. They don't really ever like define it. Like, what exactly is hate speech? What exactly is anti-Semitism? You know, and they sort of talked about, you know, racial and incitement to violence, which frankly I don't even really encounter on Twitter or like in public life in general. You know, very rarely would you encounter that sort of thing. And you know, that sort of stuff, like, you know, racial slurs, that's, you know, pretty distasteful, but it's not necessarily illegal. And really what this all boils down to, the whole concept of free speech in modern American society, what it boils down to is, are we able to openly talk about the role that Jews play in society or no? And groups like the ADL would say, absolutely not. You cannot talk about this subject. Despite how obvious it is, it's the elephant in the room. I mean, you follow any of these Jewish publications or Jewish organizations and just they openly will report on what they're up to and like sort of their agenda. I mean, the last time I think we did a podcast, we talked about the Biden administration. Whole of government approach to combating anti-Semitism, to shutting down anybody saying anything critical of the Jewish community or, you know, like our policy towards Israel and just the pro-Israel lobby that dominates Washington, D.C. They want to shut down anybody even commenting on this. That's really what this all boils down to.
Yes, they're trying to expand civil rights protection to Jews as, I guess, a protected class, even though there's a debate whether being Jewish is a religious identity or ethnic racial identity. They haven't clarified that, nor can they demonstrate any examples of Jews experiencing any broad-based discrimination or disadvantage in our society. If anything, it's the opposite. They are very privileged. Now, what's the source of that privilege is a matter of debate. But they certainly aren't a group that needs special protection. Nevertheless, they get special protection and special attention. Hence this conference at the White House earlier this summer to combat anti-Semitism. There's absolutely no evidence of it being a problem or even being close to reality in the West, particularly in the United States, which has always been a Jewish paradise, which is why they ascended to the heights of power.
Absolutely.
You know? But again, you probably agree with me. It's just an example of them wildly exaggerating and playing the victim in an attempt to avoid any accountability for their misdeeds or abuses of power.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and see, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, this is like the most privileged, the most worshipped group. I mean, you can even see like some of the public opinion polls. Like, you know, everybody seems to have this very, very positive attitude towards Jews. And, you know, and again, it's like, the one thing in society we're not allowed to talk
well,
about,
they,
despite
you,
how
you,
obvious
you,
it is.
You better.
I mean,
you better have a very positive attitude.
That's the thing. Like, yeah. How dare you not? Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, well, and again, this is like the most important issue, I think, facing our society is, do we have the ability to talk about these people? And talk about what they're up to, talk about the sort of agendas that they promote, the sort of policies they promote politically and you know what the ultimate result is for our country. And that's the thing. It's like it's just so insulting anymore to like you can't even have like a grown-up conversation about these issues. And you know, here's a guy like Elon Musk who will tell you he's, you know, his entire life story is pro-Semitic. He loves Jews. There's, you know, the Jews never did anything wrong. You know, they're the best group of people out there, according to this guy. And yet he will still be denounced as this anti-Semite who is allowing quote unquote hate speech and anti-Semitism to flourish on Twitter. Did you see the that group of, I think it was like 100 Jewish leaders that just launched this campaign to boycott any sort of advertising on Twitter? I mean, they've been doing this for quite a while. I mean, the ADL was sort of leading this effort earlier this summer, but there's like another initiative to launch.
That's
this
a. I thought that was
out of Twitter. Go ahead.
I thought that was an anti-Semitic trope that they do that. Jonathan Rebat denied doing.
Yeah,
that.
Exactly.
Just the presumption that they're in a position to dictate what people think and say about any number of issues, even about themselves or their organizations. And again, they have such a wide definition of anti-Semitism that it prevents you from engaging any meaningful public discourse on any number of issues. Rolling Stone apparently thinks that if you advocate not watching pornography, that's anti-Semitic.
I wonder why that would be.
Well, if you understand their thinking, you can.
Yeah, by the way, that the organization that is launching this most recent boycott of Twitter, or the advertising campaign to boycott Twitter, is a group called X Out Hate, and it's like over 100 Jewish leaders that have come together. This is a direct quote from them. As Jewish leaders of all backgrounds, current and former leaders of Jewish organizations, artists and activists from all over the country, we have watched in horror as a new stage in anti-Semitic discourse has spread like wildfire on one of America's largest social media networks. And of course, they're referring to X or Twitter, you know, under Elon Musk, and they talk about how X has become a breeding ground for some of the most dangerous anti-Semitic discourse in America, and basically argued that Musk spreading a neo-Nazi ideology. What planet are these people living on? I mean, like, the disconnect from reality here is so shocking. It's like, how can they even say these things? Incredible.
Well, because there's no consequences for just lying.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, talk about, like, gaslighting. I mean, they will literally tell you the total opposite of reality and expect you to blindly go along with it.
Well, you have this, you know, this 100 different organizations coming together to boycott Twitter X and attack Elon Musk's business. Is that the idea?
That is exactly what they're proposing.
And
X out hate.
So, but it's anti-Semitic. Do you think Jews coalesce to do these things?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you start noticing patterns and recognizing what these people are up to, and it's instantly demonized as anti-Semitism. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, to really like understand what even is anti-Semitism, you know, you look at like the ADL. They do like these big international, you know, like public opinion type polls to quote unquote assess anti-Semitic attitudes around the world. And it's like just basically noticing easily demonstrable facts about Jews, their role in Hollywood, their role in the government, their role in the media, that sort of thing. So if like you just factually recognize what these people are up to, it's anti-Semitism according to them. It's not even like, you know, like, again, like the way they try to portray it is like, you know, people are making, you know, distasteful slurs about Jews or against Jews. I don't, honestly, like, don't even ever see that ever, like, on social media or Twitter or anywhere. It's nobody's really inciting violence against these people. We're just trying to have a grown-up conversation about what sort of policies they're pursuing, what sort of power they have in our government and in our broader society.
Well, according to Jonathan Greenblatt, the ADL is just a little old nonprofit operating out of New York, and Elon Musk is this titan of industry. So it really is a David versus Goliath relationship here. And, you know, who is the ADL? They're just again, they have no power. They don't represent any power. But nevertheless, they can organize behind the scenes a global boycott of Elon Musk for simply permitting more speech on his social media platform. It's not really free speech, it's freer speech. Because if you do actually engage in the type of things that they're accusing you of doing, they will ban you, by the way, if you do engage in outright, you know, anti-Semitic.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't – do you have a Twitter account, by the way?
Yes.
Do you have, like, a personal one? Okay, yeah. I was going to say, I mean, I've had Twitter for years now, but I've been able to get any sort of traction on it because, I mean, you're basically shadow banned if
yes.
you know, talk about these sorts of things, or, you know, you're a quote unquote conspiracy theorist or whatever. You know, you just simply think critically for yourself and you're basically shadow banned. And that, so, like, I think that actually, arguably, under Elon Musk, Twitter is even more censored than ever. I mean, you recently interviewed James Edwards, who's a great radio host. He's also a contributor to American Free Press. He was banned on Twitter just earlier this summer, along with Dr. Kevin McDonald. And many – Taylor has been banned on Twitter for years. Nick Fuentes, Andrew Eng, and pretty much all the big names in the alternative media have been banned on and if you're not banned, like me, I'm not banned, but – my account is basically shadow banned to where, like, the only way to see anything I post on Twitter is you have to specifically go to my page.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's not going to show up in your feed. You know, you're not going to be able to, you know, really see anything I'm tweeting unless you go directly to the page. And that's part of Elon Musk's whole strategy to – and this comes directly from the ADL. That's the thing that's so incredible is Elon Musk has basically openly worked with the ADL since he took over to come up with some of these policies. What do they call it? Freedom of speech, but not freedom of reach.
Yeah.
Where, okay, yeah, you can say what you want, but you're not going to be able to – nobody's going to be able to see it unless they go directly to your page. And if you do say something too far out of line, we will ban you, you know? Or if you do start getting some sort of momentum, some sort of popularity, then we will ban you. And that's exactly what's happened.
And the question is, who is the ADL to decide these things?
Well, right. I mean, who gave them this tremendous power and influence to like dictate what can and can't be said on all of these top social media platforms? Why are they in charge of regulating quote unquote free speech? You know, that's the thing that is never that's the number one question we should be asking. Why are these people telling us what we can and can't say, or what we can and can't talk about, what sort of ideas we can and cannot entertain?
Yes, at the same time, they illustrate and actually demonstrate how the Jewish lobby or organized community operates, pressing their interest, their perceived interest. If you point that out, they'll call you anti-Semitic. At the same, you employing the very tactics that you're highlighting when you call it, when you criticize them for such tactics, but they're doing it. It's the ultimate gaslighting.
Exactly. It's all so – it is, yeah, and it's all so tiresome and ridiculous.
Well, no one ever – a good example is whenever Jonathan Greenblatt – I've never seen him challenged face-to-face on any one of these shows he goes on. They ask – people are very deferential, and then no one ever says, Johnny baby, who are you? Who's the ADL? Why do you have so much power? Why are – a good example is the of this is when you had this struggle session apparently that Elon Musk had. It's all with Jews. Is there any non-Jew invited to perhaps to give an alternative point of view on these matters? When they have a national conference on anti-Semitism, and what they call anti-Semitism is just growing criticism of outsized Jewish power. Do they have anyone else there to say, hey, wait a second, there's a reason what you call anti-Semitism, which is criticism, is because you're doing this, that, and the other thing, and people don't like it. There's never any of that. It's assumed that they are innocent victims.
Yes, absolutely. Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, that goes to the heart of it. And, of course, much of this is tied up with the official Holocaust story, because mm-hmm. that is always invoked. In fact, I was just on Twitter earlier today. And Merrick Garland, the attorney general, is up there saying that, you know, his – let me see if I could find it exactly. Basically, like, what drives him is his family's experience in the Holocaust.
I mean, you're the attorney general of the United States. That's not supposed to be what motivates you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, this is – it's, like, so central to, like, his identity. It's, like, his
– yes.
It's the most important aspect of his identity.
Yeah, when he was – a couple of weeks ago, when he was up there being questioned about his abuse of power, his Department of Justice abuse of power, FBI and Department of Justice, particularly the harassment of Catholics, his response was, my grandmother almost died in the Holocaust, and I have relatives who died in the Holocaust. And it's an insult to suggest, given my family background, that I would ever abuse my power – for religious persecution. So what he's saying is because he's Jewish, he cannot be suspected of abusing power.
Yeah.
That's basically what he was saying when he responded to that. Because I'm a Jew, you can't question my motivation or how I dispose of or execute my powers. So you're persecuting Christians, Catholics in this case, and you're saying you're allowed to do it because you're Jewish. That's what I get. I mean, that's what you infer from that.
Right. Well, no. I mean, he was pretty clear. That's exactly what he was saying.
Because no one was asking him. No one was asking about his family history. They ask you, why are you persecuting these people? And he goes off. He goes into his family history about some lachrymose history about how oppressed his descendants were, or ancestors were rather. I mean.
Right. Well, I mean, and this is very typical of all these people, all these political officials, especially if they're Jewish. I mean, they're. Their Jewish identity is so fundamentally tied to this whole Holocaust story, which, you know, dozens of serious investigators and revisionist historians have completely disproven the entire official story of the Holocaust itself.
Might it affect how they conduct themselves in their office?
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. I mean, that's – as you said, I mean, this guy, he'll tell you himself. This is what his whole life is revolved around is – family's experience in the Holocaust, why he devotes his life to quote unquote upholding the rule of law, which I think any objective observer would conclude, especially under the Biden administration, the entire rule of law has been totally weaponized against conservatives, against white Americans. I mean, as soon as Biden stepped foot in the White House, everybody was saying the same thing about how, you know, white supremacy and, you know, domestic extremism were the greatest threat to the country. Meanwhile, Black Lives Matter and Antifa activists are literally burning down cities across the country. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow it's always white people's fault. we're the number one threat facing the country, according to these people.
Well, yeah, you have offers like the Southern Poverty Law Center gleefully charting the decline of the white majority. And then they say, if you notice that, you're a white identitarian nationalist supremacist, whatever that means. At the same time, we found out there was that the Fortune 100 companies in the past few years have hired of all their higher is it management, only 6% are white. So 94% are people of color.
I saw that report. Yeah, it's like you can't even get a job in corporate America anymore if you're white.
Isn't that a violation of the Civil Rights Act?
Well, you'd think, but I think the whole Civil Rights Act was designed to elevate non-whites over whites, and that's exactly what we've seen ever since the implementation of these sorts of laws.
They effectively don't apply to white Americans yet.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and this is all like this is all becoming so like with each day it's like becoming more and more obvious what's going on, and especially and that's why this whole ban the ADL hashtag was so important, I think, and just the fact that Elon Musk was talking about it and you know giving some traction to this, I think, is very important. It's definitely helping these sorts of ideas become more and more mainstream, and yet still Musk, and I don't know what you think about him personally, but he's kind of like a Trump type figure where he'll like say some interesting things, but then like always let you down somehow at the end of the day. You know what I mean? It's kind of the same way with him. I mean, just this right. And right before he did this, this Twitter space with Ben Shapiro and all these other Jewish leaders where they were basically running cover for him and saying how good he was for Jews and how he's not an anti-Semite. And, you know, he's the most pro-Semitic person out there, these sorts of things. He had a meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu in New York. Did you see that?
Yes. Yeah.
And they were, I mean, ostensibly the whole conversation was about, you know, artificial intelligence and the future of AI and how Israel is going to play a leading role developing AI and these sorts of things. And Netanyahu gets up there and he's like, you know, Elon, I know you're dedicated to free speech and you seem like you're a very good guy and, you know, you care about anti-Semitism that Jews experience. So I hope that you can work within the confines of the First Amendment to stop anti-Semitism. It's like, don't you understand that's the whole purpose of the First Amendment is to protect controversial speech, not shut it down, not work within the confines? I mean, it's like, it doesn't even make sense. But this is the sort of mindset that these people have.
What he's saying is that Israel, the Israeli government, the Mossad, Shin Bet, Israeli Defense Force, the American Zionist Council, World Jewish Congress, AIPAC, ADL, presidents and leaders of major Jewish organizations, all that power structure has to be immune from criticism lest you engage in anti-Semitism.
Yep. I mean, that's certainly the way that they present it. I mean, even openly recognizing what these people are doing and quoting them specifically. I mean, that's the thing that's so incredible to me is like just following – go on Twitter and follow Jonathan Greenblatt and look what he's tweeting and the sorts of things that he's promoting. Or follow their website. Follow any of these Jewish publications. I mean, I pretty much only explicitly follow Jewish publications anymore, like the Jewish Telegraph Agency, for example, or the Times of Israel, or the Jewish Daily Forward. And it is incredible what they themselves will openly report on to their own people. I mean, all these publications are, you know, written from a Jewish perspective for a Jewish audience. But I mean, you can follow them and see what they're writing. And in many cases, they're openly boasting and bragging about their power and influence, about the role that they played in Hollywood and in the government and so many other aspects of society. So it's like even scholarly, like recognizing what they're up to is anti-Semitism to these people.
Well, this is why they don't let someone like Kevin McDonald on Twitter, because he's not engaging in, you know, in crude rhetoric or anything. He's, you know, his arguments are well presented and logical and factual.
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading Culture Critique, and I don't know exactly, but I would bet like over half of the references, like the footnotes, are from explicitly Jewish sources. I mean, he's like literally quoting them, and you know, that sort of thing. And that's why I follow the explicitly Jewish press, because it's incredible what they themselves will openly report on.
And they can, because the mainstream press, which is largely controlled by Jews, won't report on it, you know. And it's so much so people are so, I think they've internalized it so much that even to say, I mean, you flinch when you say Jew. The Jews do this. That sounds it sounds crude and simplistic.
Even saying the word out loud, yeah.
Yeah, you sound like, it sounds like it's crude and retrograde and ignorant and but we talk about but we do say things like the Germans and the Japanese in reference to World War II, in our language. This is how we speak. But there is a collective Jewish identity, and there's organizations that they use to advance what they believe to be their interests. And so we have to speak in these terms. We have to speak in generalities because they operate under the umbrella of these major organizations, which is supported by over 80% of the Jewish people in the country. So it is they are representative of the Jewish people. And so what they're saying is you can't acknowledge that influence, that power, that organization, and contend with it in the public sphere, in politics or public discourse. They have to shut it down. The fact that they can shake down and intimidate, make someone like Elon Musk, who technically is the richest man in the world, grovel, speaks volumes. It's pathetic.
Oh, absolutely. It is quite pathetic. It's sad. I mean, is there anybody anywhere in America that will stand up to these people? At least anybody with any sort of big platform or power, you know, any sort of power or influence? And the answer is obviously no at this point.
You have to have nothing to lose.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess Kanye did say some interesting things. What was that last November? I think he started. When he said he was going to go DEFCON 3 on the Jews.
And within 48 hours, he found out.
All of that a couple months later.
Yeah, because within 48 hours, he found out he was no longer a billionaire.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. He lost, like, his whole entire net worth practically.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and see, this is the thing. I mean, this is the most important issue facing the country. And, you know, if we want to be serious about solving any of these political problems, this issue has to be addressed. The role that Jews play in society, the sorts of
think
policies
about,
that they promote.
If you say they're not living under a system of Jewish supremacy, how do you explain, was it whole of government approach to fighting anti-Semitism? The fact that that's the
whole of government
whole of government approach
to that's countering anti-Semitism.
Basically
yeah.
What they're saying is a totalitarian approach of combating anti-Semitism. If anti-Semitism were a real problem, the government wouldn't be doing this. The same with white supremacy. If white supremacy existed, there wouldn't be investigations into white supremacy. It would be the power structure.
Right.
You know, so it's self-refuting if you think about it.
I mean, the fact that – yeah. I mean, the fact that literally the entire federal government is so dedicated to combating anti-Semitism. I mean, when we did that podcast, we were going over some of the details of the strategy of the approach, the whole of government approach. And I mean, it was like all of these top Jewish leaders, all these top Jewish organizations like the ADL, for example, meeting directly with leading officials in the Biden administration, mm-hmm. showing like this is the priorities of the federal government. This is what these people are concerned about. It's all about protecting Jews and preventing any sort of open criticism or questioning of just what exactly they are up to.
Which they define as anti-Semitic. So if you're not philo-Semitic, you're anti-Semitic.
Right. Basically, yeah. That's basically the way it's presented, the way it's talked about. I don't know if you watched that entire interview or this session with Elon Musk and Ben Shapiro and all those other Jewish leaders. But one other thing he said that was pretty interesting, I thought anyways, is he said that all the conspiracy theories have been proven true. Like about the COVID vaccine, for example, I thought that was very interesting because, I mean, again, and it's sort of like why he's such like an interesting figure, because he'll say things like this, like where, you know, he'll give some credence or some, you know, spread these sorts of ideas, you know, questioning the media, questioning official narratives, you know, these sorts of COVID operation. But I thought that was very interesting. I mean, the fact that he was up there talking about how the quote-unquote conspiracy theories have actually been proven to be true, I thought was very, very interesting. So it's like he's going in the right direction, but he just isn't totally there yet, it seems like.
Now, was he in the same room with these people?
No, I think it was a Twitter space. It was like kind of like a podcast that they do that you can do through Twitter.
Okay. So basically, he was surrounded by Jews playing the good cop.
Right. Exactly. Running cover for him, essentially. Ben Shapiro. Boy, that guy's got one of the most annoying voices I think I've ever heard. Him and Elon Musk both have actually very kind of weird voices. But yeah, no, I mean, that's really what the whole conversation was all about. And then, of course, he did make some other sort of interesting comments about the conspiracy theories, for example. But overall, his message was he loves Jews and Twitter is doing everything in its power to shut down anti-Semitism and de-amplify hate and that sort of thing. That's what's so amazing is like he's literally like worked directly with the AL to implement all of these policies to de-amplify anti-Semitic content, to, the whole freedom of speech but not freedom of reach, to basically shadow ban anybody that's saying anything critical of Jews. It's like, how much more does he need to do to appease these people? He can't appease these people. They want to totally financially ruin him.
Yeah, they won't allow any bit of debate. It's like they don't want any maneuverability. They're upset that Jews only get 94% of the Homeland Security grants. What's the other 6% going to? Right. And so that's they don't tend to acknowledge limits, which is their downfall eventually. And so that it's almost as if what they're doing here with Elon Musk is so obvious.
Speaking, yeah.
You know, it's hard to deny it. It's, I thought Elon Musk was powerful. Why is he groveling? You know, like the Jonathan Greenblatt, we're, right. In this relationship, we're just a little old nonprofit operating in New York. Elon Musk is, he's this multi-billionaire, It says, well, no, you represent a vast power structure of trillions of dollars, a global Jewish network. And that's why you exist. That's why you were created, to protect it, to protect the criminals, the mafia that helped establish Israel and, Murder Incorporated and got a stranglehold on the U.S. government in some part, in the middle part of the 20th century. And you're there to protect that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that comment, oh, we're just this little nonprofit in New York. Give me a break. They have offices all across the country. I think they have an office in Israel. I think they even have offices in Europe.
They have 27 offices in the United States.
Yeah.
And they have people ensconced in the FBI.
Yeah,
they work with the FBI. Not only do they work with the FBI, they tell the FBI what to do.
and they're sending the FBI agents to the Holocaust Memorial Museum with an ADL handler. I mean, they're very much tied up.
There's a letter from Frank Mueller when he was FBI director, thanking the ADL for meeting with him.
Yeah.
So who's the power in that relationship? Exactly. He's the supplicant in that relationship.
So much for this small little nonprofit with no influence. Give me a break.
Well, what happens is when he says that, and if there is any honesty or integrity in that studio, everyone should just burst out laughing when he said that.
Yeah.
Because at this point, you need to start laughing, ridiculing, and laughing at these people. Because everyone knows it's a lie. And he's everyone knows that's a lie. ADL represents the Jewish power structure, which is probably the premier faction of whoever rules the world.
Right.
And it's almost like you have to start laughing.
What's interesting is people like Ben Shapiro, for example, and some of these other like more. It's almost like, Shapiro and more conservative type organization, and it's like, guys, it's a Jewish organization. Like, just go to their website. it's fundamentally tied into their Jewish identity. Yeah, I guess you could consider some of their stuff maybe a little bit more left wing politically, but overall, this is a Jewish organization advancing Jewish interests and seeking to shut down anybody that's quote unquote espousing Semitism, which, as we've been discussing, is just publicly recognizing what role Jews play in society.
Then you can acknowledge that, then have the debate, but know where everyone stands.
Right. Well, I mean, as long as the myth of the Holocaust, remains the central, focus of historical understanding, then we're never going to be able to talk about the role that Jews play in society, the bedrock of all of this. It all goes back to the Holocaust. It all goes back to the official World War II narrative. And until we can openly talk about that as adults and question exactly what we've been told, they're going to continue to maintain this privilege in our society and take what we can and can't talk about on social media.
Yeah, it prevents you from criticizing them, because if you do criticize them, you're bringing on another Holocaust. You know, this is what the Nazis did. You know, the Nazis called out, you know, the Jewish power and influence in Germany. And so if anyone else does that, you're on par, you know, with history's ultimate baddies, which are the Nazis, because of that narrative. Which is why they protect it so viciously if they have to. And they'll literally put people in jail for questioning it.
Oh, sorry about that. I had myself muted. Yeah. They would put they'd love to put people here in America in jail too for questioning the Holocaust if they could. You know, they've certainly hinted at that for sure. I mean, look at like Netanyahu, for example. We need to stop anti-Semitism within the confines of the First Amendment. What does that even mean? You know, it's like totally contrary to the very spirit of free speech and of the First Amendment. But this is how these people operate. They are like the ultimate tyrants. You know, they don't want anybody questioning anything that they say. And if you do, again, it's tied into the whole world. And oh, it's, you know, it's a Holocaust. You're like Hitler. You know, you want to innocent Jews. It's like, geez, this is just ridiculous anymore.
Well, I mean, really, what they should do, if John Greenblatt were really being confronted, ADL being confronted with this, when he's interviewed, they ask him, do you believe in the First Amendment? And he would say, of course I do. Of course, but there are limits, blah, blah, blah. Says, but doesn't the First Amendment define what America is? You get, of course it does. We've stood up for the First Amendment, for oppressed minorities. And then it says, well, when you come out against the First Amendment, you're anti-American. Is the ADL anti-American? What about those people who say the ADL is anti-American when you come out against the First Amendment just to ward off things that you don't want to hear? Isn't there anything more un-American than that? See, I'm here to respond to that.
Right. Yeah, well,
but no one ever.
We're still waiting for somebody to even
say it.
I mean, he's never going to be challenged on any of this stuff. Yeah,
he doesn't let himself get challenged.
Well, it shows. It was the privilege that these people have. I mean, no one's going to ask him any of these tough questions, and they'll continue to dictate what we can and can't say on social media. They'll continue to brainwash our FBI agents and, you know, other aspects of the federal government to advance their own particular interests.
But did you recently, well, not recently, but past 7 months, Roger Waters has caught the ire of the ADL and the Jewish community for his statements regarding Israel and Palestine. And now they're accusing him of being a Nazi and anti-Semite. You know, now he's kind of a liberal, I think. But it's almost nonsensical because they're criticizing him for his wall performances, where he comes out dressed like a authoritarian, you know, figure, and they're trying to get the public to believe he's doing that to promote it. Well, no, this is anti-authoritarianism that he's doing. It's just his get-up. But they're trying to say by doing that, you're somehow promoting anti-Semitism. When he's criticizing authoritarianism, it doesn't even make any sense. But it doesn't matter because by criticizing the Israelis and their policies regarding the Palestinians, he now becomes an anti-Semite. And now a documentary that was created. I guess it's called "The Dark Side of Roger Waters." Cute, you know, Dark Side of the Moon. And now apparently they have some musicians that worked with some Jewish musicians.
I have not heard of that.
And they're coming out how he's criticized Jewish food. All this hearsay stuff. How he said things in the past.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, now, given how Jews behave, I think most people have probably uttered what they would consider anti-Semitic remarks, which is criticism or, say, an expression of that they've lost patience with Jews. Right, because a lot of people are critical of Jews, So by their definition, that's anti-Semitic and you're a Nazi, but it's just simply an honest or a very human understandable response to the way Jews behave in many cases. But now here, you know, this old rock star, aging boomer rock star, is now the subject of a documentary they produce. And it's been, and you know, it's just some ham-fisted documentary. It's being promoted, you know, in the mainstream press for some reason, you know. But they can't even cope with Roger Waters saying some bad things about Israel. They have to shut him, try to ruin his, what remains of his career.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they've been sort of targeting him for a very long time because he has, you know, criticized Israeli policy in the Middle East and things like that. And yeah, I haven't seen the documentary, or I didn't even know about it. That's pretty interesting. I bet it's sounds like just one big hit job. But yeah, this is, I mean, again, this is the sort of tactics that these people use. I mean, look at what they're doing to Musk. Look at what they're doing to Roger Waters. Look at what they did to Kanye. Mm-hmm. You know,
which then all it does is ratify the things that Kanye said about media and entertainment, and this supports the things that Roger Waters says, and what all critics of Jewish power say about how they operate. They do the very thing that they claim they're not doing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it makes it pretty obvious to you independently for yourself. I mean, it's so obvious what these people are up to and what their agenda is. Is, you know, it's simply just noticing basic patterns, right? You know, just, and like I said, you can go on their Twitter feed and follow their public statements. It's, none of this is some, you know, hidden conspiracy theory. It's just right plain in your face. And, you know, they'll tell you the opposite of the reality. It's like this whole gaslighting technique, and they are experts at it.
And this is how they do it, because their history is victims, and because of the Holocaust narrative, they're able to advance or promote certain causes or agendas, and because of their Jewish, identity, or you can't criticize it for fear of being called an anti-Semite. There was a recent case in Texas where a graphic novel adaptation of Anne Frank's diary was being read to a middle school classroom, and it involved a lot of sexual material, from what I understand. And the teacher ended up being fired, and the book pulled from the curriculum, or the list of books they're supposed to read. And then, of course, the usual suspects came out and claimed this was banning books and anti-Semitic. So you can't even, you know, prevent the promotion of sexual inappropriate material with kids without being anti-Semitic, because they intermix it with the Holocaust narrative, so basically you can't question,
yeah,
you know, the appropriateness of this book because it's related to the Holocaust.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And this is actually something, I recently wrote an article for the Barnes Review. It was the main editorial in the most recently published Barnes Review, the September, October issue, dealing with this, you know, they call it modern day book burning, right? You know, when these parents want to get rid of these very inappropriate, in many cases, you know, sexual books or LGBTQ plus books. And many of them are somehow, for whatever reason, are tied up with this, a lot of this Holocaust literature. So there's like this big debate about, you know, what kids should be reading in school, or what they should be encouraged to read, I guess. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, books are being removed from Amazon left and right that are questioning the Holocaust or presenting, visionist perspectives about World War II, for example. And of course, there's no outrage for those books that are genuinely being banned, right?
Well, what's the fundamental difference between curating and deciding what books should be available in a school library, which they have to do? That's the job of a librarian and a curator, decide what to have, what not to have. And it's all going to be based on limited space and all what's appropriate, you know, for the age of the readers, the people who are, you know, the patrons of the library. So you're going to have to pick and choose and discriminate, right? It's not the Library of Congress. You're not going to have every published book in there. And then also, given the fact that your clientele is going to be children, then certainly you have to decide what the appropriate material is. So you need adults in the room, well-intentioned adults in the room, not homosexual Jewish, you know, infiltrators taking over the library, which happened, or taking over the schools for that matter, as we see with the libs of TikTok and incidentally, which is actually run by a Jewish lady. But it's at the same time, they're openly calling for banning public speech, like on Twitter. Isn't that essentially the same thing? You're suppressing ideas. I mean, that's the idea. I mean, one's actually more. It's a more outrageous example of censorship than the other, because the other is just a library. Library, you know, bookstores, libraries don't carry all books, and sometimes decide what book to carry, what not to carry, based on certain criteria. The banning of social media, which is, you know, today's public space, the agora, this is how we communicate. They're actually using behind the scenes and not so behind the scenes tactics to shut public speech down, decide what's appropriate speech, what isn't. And lo and behold, what's hate speech is everything they happen to disagree with or see as sort of as frustrating or prevent or opposing their agenda. Isn't that it's a little self-serving. Again, these are questions that Jonathan Greenblatt never gets when he's on MSNBC or CNN or ABC or what have you. It's all about Tim trying to explain and justify his position and how reasonable the ADL is in these things when they're anything but, you know. Or no one ever grills John Greenblatt on the history of the ADL, its origins, why it was created. They're still lying about Leo Frank, you know. But I'm saying,
right,
banning books.
Well, that
not selling a book is not banning a book. Not stocking a book in your library is not banning a book. You know, it's like, you know, some of the material should be banned, quite frankly, from what I've seen.
Right, exactly. Yeah, a lot of this stuff is very inappropriate. And it's interesting how it all is somehow related to, like, the whole Holocaust stuff too. I mean, a lot of these books, a lot of these very controversial books, like the Anne Frank book, there's a memoir called Mouse that was really controversial. A lot of school districts were trying to remove it, you know, from the school library and stuff like that. It's all of it is, like, tied up with this Holocaust stuff. I mean, you can't, it's like the two go hand.
Yeah, it's Holocaust porn, and it's a way you can make a porn film or add sexual material to it. And sort of in a rapid and something like the Holocaust, and it becomes important or poignant or something, you know.
I know you had recently interviewed E. Michael Jones. Wasn't he making the point that one of the first examples of nudity on television was with, like, a Holocaust documentary?
It was a movie called The Pawnbroker, starring Rod Steiger. In 1965, it was about a pawnbroker. It takes place in the 60s, but he is a Holocaust survivor, and he deals with that trauma. And in that movie, there's a scene where a black prostitute takes off her blouse and exposes her breast, her nude breast, on screen. And that's the first.
And this was, like, the first time, right?
Yeah, 1965, yeah. Broke the production code. And because it was a Holocaust film, the Catholic Church, the Legions of Decency, flinched, and the code was broken. And that's when they came up with the rating system. Jack Valente came up with this rating system that we knew for a long time, PG, PG-13R, and all that. But it broke the production code, and it just because it was a Holocaust film, a serious film, that it pretty much the code broke up and Legions of Decency dissolved. The Catholic Church kind of dropped the ball there. Because at the same time in 65 when they came out Nostra Aetate, when the Catholic Church came out and condemned all forms of anti-Semitism without defining what anti-Semitism is. So we see that again and again and again. They don't define it. So what is anti-Semitism? You know, and within 7 years, you had Deep Throat being run at a first-run theater. And this never occurred. And your decency laws collapsed in the name of the First Amendment of free expression, which Alan Dershowitz championed. After all, free speech is so important that we have to expand it to cover things like pornography, even though it never was intended to cover things like pornography. But then within a few decades, Alan Dershowitz is supporting BDL and legislation banning criticism of Israel on college campuses. So much for free speech.
Right, exactly. Well, I think to me it's just interesting how, like, nudity would just go hand in hand with the whole promotion of the Holocaust, and it's really, like, just a psychological operation, and, you know, like, introducing trauma and you know, scenes of nudity and things like this to sort of, like, instill these ideas in your brain. I think it's very, very subversive. Very,
well, yeah, it's very demoralizing. At the same time, you're exploiting guilt and also undermining sexual morals with this titillating material. And it's a two-pronged
right.
attack, and we see that a lot. It's all part of the, I think it's even talked about in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
That wouldn't surprise me. Well, and that's how, you talk to like an average person, like what do they even know about the Holocaust? And the only thing they know is what they've seen in these like very exploitative Hollywood movies, like Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's literally hundreds of movies that
thousands of subplots
even presented in schools.
Yeah,
books and movies and plays and all sorts of stuff. Yeah, that's how these ideas are implanted in our mind. These narratives are implanted in our mind. It's through these horrific, traumatizing propaganda films.
Oh, I remember as a child watching Holocaust as a miniseries, 1978. I think it was CBS ran it. And I don't know if you recall, but the miniseries was sort of an event that the networks would run. So they'd run three or four times a year. They'd have a miniseries. And of course, then only being three or four networks, a lot of eyes would be on it. So it had a profound impact. In 1977, you had Roots. In 1978, you had Holocaust. And that's when that term became broadly applied to what was up until then called the Shoah. But I remember on television, you had fleeting nudity from a distance. This was breakthrough stuff. A lot of trauma scenes of torture. And remember, kids are watching this stuff. it's on network television in prime time. But it was the Holocaust. It was permitted.
Yep, exactly. It really got the ball rolling and really kind of traumatized the entire country. I've never seen that miniseries, though. That would be interesting to sit down and watch it, and certainly knowing what I know now.
It has a very young, very young James Woods, Meryl Streep, Fritz Weaver, Michael Moriarty, and it's all in English, of course. That's where you see the introduction of the Zyklon B thing, Zyklon B. And which, of course, has since been debunked. But it's all there. So you can watch it on YouTube. Last time I checked, you can watch the entire thing on YouTube.
Yeah, I'm going to have to sit down and check that out one of these days. I can only imagine how revelatory it would be to sit down and watch a documentary like that. And there's many, Holocaust films that have been very influential over the years. And that's probably one of the first main ones. And also interesting, you pointed out how really the whole concept of the Holocaust, this is what really kind of got the ball rolling, is, that even using the word Holocaust was a direct result of this TV miniseries, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the mini became popular. A book had been written called Holocaust by Martin Gilbert in the early 70s. If I recall, the historian Martin Gilbert wrote a book called The Holocaust, I think.
Well, it definitely is like the linchpin entire system we live under today. I mean, all of this stuff, official World War II narrative and the alleged Holocaust, and it's still playing such a key role in our society today. I mean, we were talking about... That's what is his central motivating factor in his life.
Yeah, you can't question Merrick Garland's abuse of power. You can't question the collapse of the United States border and the migration crisis and weaponized migration because of the Holocaust. You can't question abortion because of the Holocaust, legalized abortion because of the Holocaust. You can't question pornography because of the Holocaust. it's...
It really is. It's like the linchpin.
And what it is, it applied that whole. You saw that recently. You saw the thing in Canada.
maybe not actually. What is something relating to the Holocaust?
Yeah.
Oh, the Ukrainian guard or what? Or he was in the SS.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, Yaroslav Hunk, I think, is his name. He's a, I guess he migrated, immigrated to Canada after World War II. It's probably like Gladio operation or something. I don't know. But because the CIA actually utilized these people after World War II to get at the Russians, these SS battalions. So, but he was, I guess, honored before the Canadian Parliament as a hero fighting for Ukrainian independence during World War II. I was like, well, wait a second. These people like read know anything about history? So it's kind of embarrassing. Oddly enough, the ADL was quiet about it, but he had re been recruited to fight with the SS battalions in 1943. When he was 18, he's now 98, and so he was praised. And all of a sudden, it came out. Well, wait a second. But then again, this is where you have narratives conflicting because he's good because he's fighting Russians, right? That's good to fight Russians in Ukraine. But because of the Holocaust narrative, when these Ukrainians were fighting the Russians, which means they were really fighting against the Jews because they were responding to the Holodomor, which is largely executed by Jewish, Soviet Union, which were Jews, Yagoda and Kaganovich and these people in the Ukraine. So his motivation for joining up with the SS battalions with the Germans was, my enemy and my enemy is my friend, meaning he was there. It was his chance to fight, the Soviets. Then the war ends, of course, but then the narrative is, Nazis were bad, the Russians are good. But now it's almost like it's opposite because they're now good Nazis, like the Azov Battalion. According to the ADL, Azov Battalion are good Nazis. But it has very little to do with reality, nor does it take into account the complexities, the nuances of the ethnic conflict that characterized that area, still characterizes that area, which is why you have these conflicts, which is why you have Biden, or sorry, you have Putin claiming to be denazifying the Ukraine, which is, of course, the Zelensky regime, which is Jewish, installed by the Jews at the State Department, like Victoria Nuland. But it doesn't seem to make any the moralistic ex,
Right.
you know, the moralistic explanation for our foreign policy and our support for Ukraine, our fomenting this war against Russia with the with our proxies in the Ukraine, doesn't really make any sense. The same way, if you debunk the Holocaust narrative, the whole moral fairy tale of the Second World War is based on, largely based on the Holocaust narrative. And if that collapses, then it doesn't seem to really sustain any scrutiny anymore because it's really it's all it's, these things are all based on narratives that are that serve the interest of the powers, the contending powers, in this case the U.S. State Department, But it was funny that they didn't
Oh,
know
absolutely, yeah.
that. Wait a
It
second.
is, yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting. That whole story was kind of weird. I mean, it almost seemed like it was like a setup or something, like just to get this back in the news and get people talking about the Holocaust again and like sort of reinforcing the whole official narrative. It was very bizarre the way that all went down. But you're right. I mean, the power of narrative. I mean, that is exactly what this is all about. Whether it's the narrative of World War II or the alleged prevalence of anti-Semitism on Twitter or, in society more broadly, they're very much concerned with controlling the narrative and maintaining their monopoly on these particular narratives and not letting anybody question or deviate even slightly from it.
Yeah, even when you say, well, is this guy a Nazi? Well, he's a Ukrainian nationalist, and meaning that he fought with the forces of the Ger National Socialist Germany against the Russians. That makes him a Nazi, okay. But then again, Nazi itself is a term of derision applied to National Socialists. And the Nazis themselves, to what extent is the caricature we have of the Nazi reflective of reality? It's that itself is a narrative. And that gets a lot of people upset though, because then you start, oh, wait a second, you're shattering my paradigm here, and then you're making things very complicated. I have this neat little narrative that's been given to me that helps me understand the world as it is, which means you don't understand the world because it's all based on lies, because these are fed you to mislead you. So you do buy into these narratives. But then again, you have a situation like in Ukraine today where it doesn't make any sense. But then again, if you have a short-term memory, you're just ignorant. It won't be a problem, I guess, because you won't know enough to know that it doesn't make any sense, which is, I think, the objective of the media today and the education system today.
Right.
Mom, oh, this is only a problem if you happen to read a lot of books. You're like, wait a sec, this doesn't make any sense. You know.
Right. Yeah. No, it's true. They don't want anybody thinking independently for themselves. I mean, that's like the whole concept of a conspiracy theory. You know, that word, the way that word has been sort of turned into a weapon. It's basically just questioning an official story, questioning an official mm-hmm. narrative that we're given by the media or by the government. And as Elon Musk said, all the conspiracy theories are turned out to be true. And I think he's definitely on the right track with that one, too.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of Elon Musk because he's is he this malevolent force? Well, is he conscientiously malevolent? I don't know. I don't like some of his Neuralink and weird transhumanist stuff. He may be mistaken or misled, or realizing he's contending with trying to conduct his business and live day to day like all the rest of us and without being murdered or destroyed. At the same time, he's trying to keep it from going too far, perhaps, like, you know, when he saw that Babylon Bee was shut down for telling jokes on Twitter, that's according to the narrative, that's when he decided to buy Twitter, right? And that's what got ADL all excited, all upset, and all that. And the fact that it exposed the fact that Twitter and Google and Facebook and all these social platforms have been infiltrated by ADL installed commissars. And it goes back to the question, who are they to determine what's appropriate public discourse? I'm like, who elected them? I mean, hey, folks, come here.
Right.
You know, it's not the way it's supposed to operate. It's not the way it's supposed to, but it does.
Who put them in charge?
Yeah, you know. So it's, yeah. But it's kind of funny. I made this, I know we're getting late in the interview. Maybe we'll close it on this observation. I had someone pointed this out to me that, you know, Henry Ford was critical of Jewish power, of course. And he wrote about the protocols, and it was Dearborn Independent was his newspaper. Was it Dearborn Independent?
Right.
And devoted a lot of ink to criticizing Jews and these things. And he was a sort of a titan of industry. He actually produced something of value, that, you know, automobiles. And so you have this, again, you have within a person to Henry Ford, you have this person representing production, Midwestern production industry, whether it's agriculture industry, producing real things. He's at war with those who control usury, which is alchemy and magic, and based on fantasies and lies and distortions and trickery. And it's kind of funny that someone involved in actual producing things, which you have to be, has somewhat grounded in reality to do that, at least profitably, at war with those who are in charge of alchemy, which is finance, who are involved in distorting reality and cheating the rest of humanity through that distortion, that they would come to blows. And you get a roughly similar conflict with Elon Musk, who is building things, right? He's actually building things, supposedly. Some people say, oh, that's fake too. I don't want to get in that. But nevertheless, he's presented as someone who is involved in industry, meaning at the end of the day, he has to produce something. I know the Tesla's subsidized and all that, but I'm saying my point is he's actually involved in producing something at the end of the day, whereas who is he at war with? Jonathan Greenblatt and the ADL and all these Jewish financiers and money power who are involved in usury and alchemy. George Soros called it the alchemy of finance. He admits that it's alchemy, meaning that it's trickery, it's a fraud. And through that fraud, through the power of usury and the power of compounded interest, the gift that keeps on giving, the miracle of compound interest, the power of usury brings these titans, drives them to their knees and makes them grovel. And it shows you that's the power of finance. That's the ultimate power there. But it is funny, they're at war with reality, which is, it goes back to E. Michael Jones' thesis about Jews and how they, by their rejection of the Savior Jesus Christ, they became revolutionaries. They're at war with Logos. You know, they're at war with reality in a sense, and that's ultimately, maybe that's the sort of the spiritual conflict we're seeing played out in everyday politics. I thought that was someone made that observation. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, no, that's very spot on. I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's like these two opposing forces in the world, one for order and production, and one for chaos, the sort of revolutionary spirit that I think is a very, very way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. This sort of like Jewish rejection of logos and like the natural ordering of the world. I think that really kind of explains a lot you know, when you're looking into the whole Jewish question or the Jewish problem, is yeah, they fundamentally reject the natural ordering of the world.
Yeah, and this is why they're at war with it, and ultimately they have to. Mm-hmm. And this is difficult to say, but ultimately to end this conflict, they have to shed their Jewish identity, which is the rejection of that order of Logos. And whether you want to call it anti-Semitic, it's not in the sense that they mean it. In a sense, maybe it does. Not in the sense that they describe it. Like I'm saying this as an act of love, actually, because you're called to correct these people when they're doing something wrong. It's actually an act of love. But nevertheless, you have to identify what the wrong is. And so it was the gospel. I think it was the gospel John calls them the enemies of mankind. And that's a theological distinction. But that theological error has resulted in sort of a creation of a identity and culture, which is at war with the rest of humanity. And that's we're raised to grow up. Remember, as Americans, we're taught to that we live in a liberal society, and these things aren't supposed to matter because what matters is we're Americans, and it turns out that isn't the case.
Right.
You know, they don't see themselves as Americans first, which is why they hate America first. You know?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They're fundamentally driven by their Jewish identity. Of course, that a key part of that is the whole Holocaust story, mm-hmm. and their, you know, history of quote unquote persecution. Yeah, these are all fundamental aspects of their identity. And I mean, even a guy like Merrick Garland will openly admit that. And you know, when he's being interviewed by CBS News,
mm-hmm. he constantly brings it up.
Yeah, so, exactly. You know, they all tend to.
You know, it's one of those things. So, well, John, I think we covered it.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. It's always good to catch up with you. Keep up the great work. And yeah, we'll have to do this again in the future.
Yeah, I hope that was that okay. I know with this connection, there's been a slight delay. So I'm going to see if I can edit it to see if I can clean it up, make sure it's listenable.
Okay. Yeah, so, sounds good. I know it still seems to kind of have that issue, but I think it'll be okay.
So, okay, John. Well, thanks so much. I'll post this soon. I'll send you the link.
All right. Sounds good. Have a good night, man.
Good night. Take it easy. Bye-bye. Thanks.